ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, after a long-running campaign by aged care workers, they've secured a big pay rise. But will it improve the quality of care for the elderly? Also, science research agency, the CSIRO, hits back at criticism from the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, over its reporting on nuclear power. And concussion in sport. Is it okay to scan the brain of every new player drafted into the AFL?
I think it's something that they've had to do now because of the advancing science worldwide. It is something that I think is a good thing and providing some sort of baseline before they enter the AFL competition.
First tonight, aged care workers have had a big win today with the Fair Work Commission ruling they deserve pay rises of between 7 and 28%. The Health Services Union says the result in the long-running case is one of the best it's ever achieved, but it's concerned aged care support workers aren't getting the pay bump of their colleagues. This report from Alison Shaw.
There was tension in the room as aged care workers and their union representatives waited to hear today's results from the Fair Work Commission. And finally, after a long campaign, the news they'd been waiting for.
For personal carers, there's an increased range between 18 and 28%.
Health Services Union boss Jared Hayes broke down the results in front of his members.
Home care between 15 and 26%. There's a 6.8% increase for support services.
It's meant the whole world to me. I get really emotional. I'm really excited.
Sharon Fotu has been an aged care worker for over 25 years.
It's affected the quality of care, and I'm nearly a few years for retirement, but because I work still two jobs. So this happening today make a decision for me to quit one job and stay with one job, which is mean I spend more time with my family and loved ones.
Michelle Rope is one of the home care workers who will receive a wage boost of between 15 and 26%.
We still have a long way to go, but it means that we attract more people to work with us because it's very hard to retain people in our industry, especially in community because we're using our own cars. I look after people in their hundreds and they still live at home. And they still live at home because we can look after them at home.
Kylie Munday has worked in aged care for decades and is now a lifestyle officer, which means she organises meaningful activities for residents.
I've always had been under a lot of stress to make sure I can keep the roof over my head, pay all the bills. I've always been really worried that if something breaks down, how am I going to pay for it? So it's given me a bit of peace of mind.
But she says even with this decision, many of her colleagues haven't got the financial recognition they deserve. Cleaners, cooks and laundry hands have just received a 6.8% bump.
I'm pleased for myself, but I'm very disappointed that a lot of other staff aren't going to have don't have a good result like we do.
Sydney father Kelvin Evans works as a cleaner at an aged care centre. Given his pay rise will be much smaller, he had less cause for celebration.
A little bit bittersweet because, yes, it's a win, but and the direct care staff got big increases, which they deserve, but the rest of us, we've sort of been left behind.
A wage increase was a key recommendation of the Aged Care Royal Commission. The Fair Work Commission had already granted an interim wage increase of 15% to direct employees in the sector in 2022. That interim increase is being paid for by the federal government, costing $11.3 billion over 4 years. And now the pay increases announced today come on top of that. The sector hopes the government will cover the new increases too.
Now we need the government to commit to fully funding these wage rises as soon as possible.
That's Laura Halen from Catholic Health Australia, which runs 350 facilities around the country.
Right now we have 60,000 care and nursing vacancies, and that's projected to hit 110,000 in 6 years' time. We have an ageing population, so we need to attract thousands of staff into the sector. So this decision is really historic in terms of ensuring that we're able to remain competitive and continue to attract and retain staff.
Associate Professor Nicole Sutton is from the Ageing Research Collaborative at the University of Technology, Sydney. She says the people who rely on aged care will get better service as a result of this pay rise.
The evidence both in Australia and internationally shows how critical staffing is as an input in terms of the quality and safety of aged care services. Now, particularly in Australia, there has been new regulation to increase the staffing in aged care homes, and as well there are staffing shortages in terms of home care. So one of the critical elements in terms of improving quality is having enough skilled workers in the sector. And so having an increase in the pay is going to be really helpful in terms of attracting and retaining staff.
While the sector's support workers like cleaners and cooks will get a much smaller increase than their colleagues, Nicole Sutton says it's a step in the right direction.
At least it's a start. I mean, I think one of the problems with the earlier stages of the Fair Work Commission was that, you know, there was pay rises, the 15% came for direct care staff, and there was only kind of an increase for the head chef at an aged care home. And if you think about the sort of care that is provided to a resident, it's not just the nursing staff and the personal care workers, but it's also the people who are cleaning someone's room or doing the maintenance on the room or doing the laundry or preparing the food, preparing the cups of tea. And it's a pretty strange situation where, you know, an HR manager might walk around and go, okay, so you're getting a pay increase, but not for you. So I agree there is actually more work to be done in terms of making sure that we value the other workers within aged care, not just the care workers per se, but at least this is starting in the right direction.
Associate Professor Nicole Sutton from the University of Technology, Sydney, ending that report by Alison Shao. Dr. Matt Sherry is with Griffith University's Business School and has researched the retention of staff at aged care facilities and the well-being of the workforce. He too is disappointed that support workers in aged care, like cooks, administrators and cleaners, haven't been given a significant pay increase.
The care organisations in Australia, like Uniting Care, have been quite quick to jump on this and suggest that indirect carers have a vital role to play and really shouldn't be treated any differently as far as the award goes for these pay increases.
In terms of people doing the direct care work, as you call it, the union says the pay rise will make the aged care sector more competitive when it comes to attracting workers. It says a lot of people want to work in aged care and they're likely to move over from, say, public hospitals. Do you agree that's the case?
Yeah, I think the aged care workforce or working in aged care generally has its kind of added benefits of that it's providing, you know, an excellent public service, and you know, nurses in general want good working conditions. And so I think that the pay will go a long way into making it more competitive, but there's still a range of other issues associated with poor working conditions that I think need to be addressed before we will see that happen.
What are these conditions that need to be improved?
Yeah, so it's things like improving the staff to resident ratios, not just for nurses, but also for personal care workers and other workers within aged care. It includes things like including that there's sufficient training and development opportunities. In the past, there's been reports that this is quite insufficient. Organisations are reporting that it's insufficient, and the workers themselves are reporting that it's insufficient. And this includes things like we've seen quite an increase in demand for aged care in general, but for dementia care in particular. And a lot of our staff are not trained to be able to work in these dementia care wards, but they put in there anyway. And this creates a lot of physical and emotional strain. Things like exposure to abuse and harassment are all difficult things for the care workforce to be able to deal with.
What do you think it'll mean for the workers' morale knowing they're being paid more?
The perceived inequality means that the indirect care work workers are going to view that they're not considered to be as important. They're going to feel like they're not getting a fair deal. And what we've seen already is UnitingCare have already reported that some of their indirect care workers are, in a sense, refusing to help their direct care colleagues. We need to be very considerate of the indirect care workforce and making sure that we can improve their sense of equity. I see that as one of the major issues moving forward because, okay, we might be able to get enough direct care workers to come across from hospitals and to apply for the jobs, 60,000 jobs that we're going to need to fill over the next few years. But if we can't get the direct indirect care workforce right, then we'll see the aged care homes still not be able to staff properly, and over time they're still going to close.
Should people who have elderly loved ones in aged care or home care be confident that the standard of care will improve because of this pay increase for some workers?
I think there are a range of other factors that haven't been considered in relation to that pay increase. I think we need to look at a range of things in the sector before it's going to kind of create good characteristics and good things like retention and morale. But until we see that, I think pay is just only one part of, you know, a bigger, broader problem. And what we've seen is that because of underfunding, because we're understaffed in general across the sector, we've had plenty of reports of, you know, below world standard care. And I think that'll continue until we really do look at the full gamut of workplace factors and work conditions.
Dr. Matt Sherry from Griffith Uni's Business School. The federal government has announced it will resume funding for the main United Nations aid agency in Palestine after a controversial 2-month suspension. Australia's support for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, known as UNRWA, was put on hold after Israel alleged some of the agency's staff were involved in the Hamas attacks on October the 7th. But the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, says updated information has now led the government to change its position. This report from Isabel Massali.
Gaza's health ministry says in the past day at least 29 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks while waiting for aid, a claim Israel says is false. On the other side of the world, in Australia, Foreign Minister Penny Wong announced a reversal of a decision that impacts whether food reaches civilians.
There are two facts a responsible government can't ignore in relation to UNRWA. They do life-saving work. And the recent allegations were grave.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency has been operating for decades, providing food, housing and other essential services to Palestinian refugees. Australia has been a long-term supporter and recently increased funding. But that was disrupted in January when allegations emerged that some workers were linked to the October 7 terror attack by Hamas.
The nature of these allegations warranted an immediate and appropriate response. The best available current advice from agencies and the Australian government lawyers is that UNRWA is not a terrorist organisation and that existing and additional safeguards sufficiently protect Australian taxpayer funding.
Australia now joins Canada and the European Union in resuming funding. Penny Wong also announced additional aid, bringing Australia's total support for Gaza to $52.5 million since the conflict began. Mark Purcell from the Australian Council for International Development is among those welcoming today's move, saying the pause has been difficult.
Look, I think it's just made what is a hideously complex humanitarian crisis where people are now starving to death more fraught. Staff were basically shifting to looking at which programs would need to be wound down or suspended as funds dried up.
Jasmine Westendorf is an Associate Professor of International Relations at La Trobe University. She researches UN integrity systems, along with conflict and humanitarian response.
These allegations were serious, but the United Nations has strong integrity systems, which Australia has in the past had quite significant confidence in. And the United Nations, in every crisis and conflict situation that it works in, has to ensure that its resources are not being misused by conflicting parties. And it goes to great lengths to do that. So for Australia and other countries, Canada, the US, the EU, and so on, to pause funding for so long in the absence of any significant evidence provided, shows enormous disregard for the established UN integrity systems in this space, and also shows, I think, enormous disregard for the lives of the Palestinians who are suffering enormously as a result of this war.
She says a continued pause on the funding became untenable for Australia and other nations, given the scale of the humanitarian crisis and a lack of evidence related to Israel's claims.
The United Nations was waiting on evidence from Israel, and in the meantime, they've undertaken a full review of all staff and of their practices to ensure that their staff were not involved in October 7 and that their resources are not being funneled towards Hamas. However, no evidence for those allegations was actually provided by Israel to the United Nations.
But the opposition's foreign affairs spokesman, Simon Birmingham, disagrees and wants Australia to remain with the United States in their pause.
The allegations made against the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, that they had employees who participated in the October 7 terrorist attacks are the most grievous of allegations. And they come after long-standing concerns that have been made and raised about the way in which UNRWA operates.
Daniel Aguillon from the Executive Council of Australian Jewry has also criticised the move and wants the funding distributed to other agencies.
Clearly the people of Gaza need aid, but that aid needs to be channelled through a reputable organisation so that we as Australian taxpayers know that our money is not being misused to fund terror.
That's Daniel Aguillon from the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, ending that report by Isabel Massali. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, as concerns about concussion increase, is it okay to scan the brain of every new player drafted into the AFL? Australia's chief science agency, the CSIRO, has issued a rare rebuke to a politician after the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, criticised its cost analysis of nuclear power versus renewables. Mr Dutton had cast doubt on a CSIRO report which found the cost of generating electricity from small-scale nuclear reactors would be much higher than renewable sources like wind and solar. The head of the CSIRO says it's dangerous for politicians to disparage respected scientists. John Daly has more.
It's not often the head of the CSIRO weighs into the world of politics, but the science agency's chief executive, Douglas Hilton, has drawn a line. He's fired back at what he says are unfounded criticisms from the coalition of the CSIRO's annual energy report, GenCost.
You know, we need to avoid a situation where, as a nation, we have 50 or 60% of our population that are broadly distrustful of science. You know, we've seen how desperately difficult it was for countries that thought like that to deal with things like the pandemic. It'll be just as difficult for them to deal with net zero. We need really good debate around science, but we don't want a country that disparages science, scientists and scientific organisations. I think that would be a disaster for Australia.
The CSIRO's latest GenCost consultation report found that by 2030, a grid with 90% wind and solar power would generate electricity at $70 to $100 a megawatt hour. It predicts coal generation would be slightly more at $85 to $135 a megawatt hour. And small modular reactors, or SMRs, which are an emerging nuclear technology in favour with the opposition, would create electricity at a cost of $210 to $350 a megawatt hour in 2030. Opposition leader Peter Dutton claims the CSIRO's estimate on costs for renewables is lower than it should be. He spoke to Channel 9 this morning.
It doesn't take into consideration all of the costs around renewables. I'm strongly in favour of renewables, but we need to keep the lights on and we need to keep power prices down. Mm. And the fact that most other developed countries are adopting a zero emissions latest generation nuclear technology means that we could get greener power, we could get cheaper power, but also reliable power as well.
Alison Reeve is the Deputy Director of the Energy Program at the Grattan Institute. She says the coalition's criticisms of the CSIRO's modelling aren't entirely accurate.
It doesn't include the cost of the parts of the system, the transmission lines and so on, that already exist, because those things have already been built and paid for. People have tried to say that the GenCos costs come in too low because they're not including those existing system costs, but that's wrong.
One of the criticisms from the opposition is that GenCos doesn't take into account transmission costs as well as the costs for subsidies. What do you think of that?
When you do any sort of modelling exercise, you always put subsidies and taxes outside the model because those are things that change a lot over time.
Nuclear energy advocates outside the coalition are also unhappy with the GenCost report. The Australian Nuclear Association points out that the CSIRO used only one failed SMR project in the US state of Utah to base its modelling off. That project has already gone belly up because of high costs. CSIRO's Douglas Hilton says that's because there aren't any other real-world examples of the nascent technology.
So again, what was done was to use the best available data, which was from that project. In fact, it's the only credible available data.
GenCost hasn't modelled the costs of large-scale nuclear reactors, saying large-scale nuclear isn't a suitable option for Australia. Harries says the CSIRO's assessment of nuclear energy is superficial.
And these were just SMRs. This is just ignoring the whole concept of large reactors, such as those built in the United Arab Emirates. I guess they felt they had to include nuclear, but it should be done properly.
CSIRO's Douglas Hilton says other countries with large-scale nuclear have had that infrastructure and expertise for decades, whereas Australia has none, making it an incredibly costly and implausible option. He says CSIRO remains agnostic, in a sense.
The work we've done and the data we've provided is absolutely agnostic to the technology. And what I'd ask is that people don't confuse the data and the science with the policy debate.
The CSIRO's Chief Executive Douglas Hilton, that report from John Daly. Well, according to Queensland's Chief Health Officer, the term long COVID should be scrapped after a new report concluded the symptoms aren't much different to those people suffer after other viral infections. But the report's conclusions are being criticised by long COVID sufferers. Rima Chia has more.
Luke McFarlane is only 19 years old, but his one experience with COVID has turned his world upside down.
I got COVID in, 2022, last year of high school. Had to drop out halfway through because I couldn't continue with the schoolwork as I was sleeping for, 14 hours a day. Couldn't think straight, still can't. Bit of brain fog, massive fatigue.
As a young person, Luke didn't expect his experience with the virus to damage his quality of life.
I'd probably have to say these are the worst 2 years of my life, really. I don't wish it on anyone.
Luke is one of hundreds of thousands of people who have COVID symptoms that continue to impact their overall well-being. But Queensland's Chief Health Officer Dr. John Gerard thinks calling it long COVID is a mistake.
I believe it is time to stop using the term long COVID. Using this term implies that this virus has some unique, exceptional and sinister property that differentiates it from other viruses and makes it far worse.
He presented a study of more than 5,000 people, which found the lingering effects of COVID are similar to the seasonal flu and other respiratory illnesses a year after infection. Queensland Health surveyed participants twice over 12 months, asking about ongoing symptoms and functional impairments. The questionnaire was delivered by text message. John Gerard says he's not questioning what patients say they're experiencing.
I want to make it clear that the symptoms that some patients described after having COVID-19 are real, and we believe they are real. What we are saying is that the incidence of these symptoms is no greater in COVID-19 than it is with other respiratory viruses, and that to use this term long COVID is misleading and, I believe, harmful.
Dr. Gerard says that whatever symptoms people have, they should be specifically identified, like chronic fatigue or inflammation, instead of being labelled as long COVID. But the study itself has raised eyebrows among other experts, like Dr. Stephen Foe from the Long COVID Clinic at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney.
The study isn't without its flaws. Over 5 million people in Queensland have had COVID. So we're talking about 150,000 people would fit into Suncorp Stadium three times. And to suggest that by not calling it long COVID, you would be, you know, helping those people not to focus on their symptoms is a curious conclusion from that study. It's an unusual approach.
The Queensland Government, in its submission to the National Inquiry into Long COVID, said it was moving away from the term and pushed back against the reporting of individual cases. Dr. Peter Smith of the National Centre for Neuroimmunology and Emerging Diseases at Griffith University says long COVID has not been a particular focus for Queensland.
There hasn't been a large focus on long COVID clinics, and again, that may be health resource and expertise and guideline driven. It's been difficult to create long COVID clinics with lack of evidence of what to do to go forward. So it's been very difficult. I don't think that they've downturned treating it. I think there hasn't been enthusiasm in treating it. As a clinician, I haven't had any issues with treating it. I've seen a lot more enthusiasm, proactivity in other states in Australia.
Dr. Peter Smith from the National Centre for Emerging Diseases at Griffith University. Rima Chia with that report. Now to the growing concerns about concussion in contact sports. The AFL is considering scanning the brains of new AFL players before they start their professional careers. But would that reduce their risk of concussion-related injuries? This report from Oliver Gordon.
In front of a packed MCG at last year's AFL preliminary final, Melbourne player Angus Brayshaw is flattened.
Oh, he was met solidly after he got rid of it. I think he's had some damage done here and he may have been knocked out, Brayshaw. He has not.
The Fox Footy commentary team didn't know it at the time, but the incident would end Brayshaw's decorated playing career and thrust the league's uncomfortable relationship with concussion back into the spotlight.
So Angus Brayshaw on the stretcher down and he'll have the best treatment.
The AFL requires players who've suffered a concussion to take 12 days off. Earlier this month, it mandated a 21-day break for all levels below the top grade. Now it's been revealed the league is considering a radical new idea that would involve scanning the brains of AFL draftees before they start their careers. The move could provide a benchmark to monitor any changes to the brain throughout the player's career. Professor Alan Pearce is from La Trobe University's Australian Sports Brain Bank.
I think it's something that they've had to do now because of the advancing science worldwide. It is something that I think is a good thing and providing some sort of baseline before they enter the AFL competition.
He wants to know which type of scans would be done.
The most obvious one is what we see in hospitals, which are MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging, or CT scans, and they're the ones that are used on a daily basis. But there are also more advanced scans as well, such as DTI, which is diffusion tensor imaging, which is a lot more detailed in what you can see in the brain.
While CABC can confirm the AFL is strongly considering this brain scan project, its details, implementation and timeline remain unclear. If it does get over the line, Professor Pearce says striking a balance between privacy and player safety could prove challenging.
Is the player discriminated against if there are two or three players touted by an AFL club and one has a history of concussions and it shows up, you know, are they discriminated against and does the player have some case of to argue, given that they have no symptoms, they're playing well, everything else is fine except for these particular scans.
Sydney University bioethicist Dr. Diego Silva agrees.
If athletes have had previous surgeries on their knees, that this is going to be taken into account. So, look, why wouldn't
issues of neurology also be taken into account.
The issue of concussion and player safety has proven to be a vexed issue for the AFL. Last year, a class action led by former Geelong player Max Rook was lodged against the AFL by former players who claimed their health has been permanently damaged by head knocks. But Dr. Diego Silva says it's not just the league and players who need to think about their involvement with the sport.
What does it mean when we give our dollars and our eyeballs to these sports? I think it raises a whole host of very gnarly ethics questions for all of us.
Sydney Uni's bioethicist Dr. Diego Silva, ending that report from Oliver Gordon. That's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Lena El-Sadi, David Sargent and David Lawford. I'm Samantha Donovan. You'll find all our reports and interviews on the PM webpage. The PM team will be back on Monday evening. Thanks for your company this week. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Decades ago, when other countries were embracing nuclear power, Australia put a ban on it. Now the federal opposition wants to lift that ban and build nuclear power plants on the sites of ageing coal-fired power stations. Today, we look into the feasibility of that idea. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.